This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. Its last act was the destruction of Smyrna.
The Turkish army entered the city on September 9, and very rapidly, within hours, the army was out of control, and it went to the Armenian quarter. The city was divided into districts and began a slaughter. It was pulling people from their homes, raping the women, killing the families, looting the businesses, and so forth. It was just a horrible scene.
That's Lou Yurenik. We talk with him about his book, The Great Fire. It's not only a story of genocide, but also one of incredible bravery and heroism by an improbable American rescuer. We also talk with British novelist Lissa Evans about her delightful thriller set in wartime England. It's called Crooked Heart. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The refugee crisis going on now in Europe, with people fleeing war in Syria and elsewhere, is but the latest iteration of the terrible history of the displacement of peoples in modern times. One of the first took place 100 years ago in the waning days of the Ottoman Empire. That's when the Turkish army went after hundreds of thousands of Christians, Armenians, and Greeks in a murderous campaign of religious and ethnic cleansing. The final episode of what's been called the Armenian Genocide was the burning down of the great city of Smyrna by Turkish troops. Smyrna was a mostly Christian city within the Ottoman Empire, a place of fabulous wealth and cosmopolitan culture. When Kemal Atatürk's army came rampaging, it was improbably an American citizen who risked the wrath of his government to rescue thousands of Smyrna civilians. My guest, journalist Lou Yurenik, tells the fascinating story in his book, The Great Fire, One American's Mission to Rescue Victims of the 20th Century's First Genocide. Lou Yurenik teaches journalism at Boston University. His writing has appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, and the Boston Globe. Well, Lou Yurenik, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, The Great Fire, tells a story of a conflagration that destroyed Smyrna in 1922. Before we get into the meat of the story, first, tell us about the place, Smyrna.
Sure. It was an exceptional city. Nothing quite like it in the Mediterranean, certainly in the Ottoman Empire. Smyrna was a very rich city, cosmopolitan, sophisticated. It was rich by virtue of the products that it exported. Tobacco, a lot of tobacco went to the United States. In fact, the American cigarette industry was made possible by the Turkish tobacco that passed through Smyrna. Cartel for Oriental carpets, opium, dried fruits. All sorts of things passed through Smyrna, creating fabulous wealth for its residents. Palatial homes, villas of the sort that we associate with Newport, Rhode Island, and the robber barons, all of that. It was also exceptional in that it was a majority Christian city inside the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire, of course, was an Islamic theocracy. It was a caliphate, all of that, run by the Sultan. But the city of Smyrna was majority Christian, principally because of the Greek population, but also the Armenian population. There were more Greeks at Smyrna than there were in Athens in 1922. It was also exceptional because it was a tolerant and liberal city. Different faiths and ethnicities lived together pretty much in harmony at Smyrna. Muslims, Christians, Jews, the Europeans, the Levantines, so-called, who lived there. And so it was a kind of, maybe a city-state is a little strong because it was definitely governed by the Ottoman Empire, but it was sort of a place apart. Even during the worst of the Armenian Genocide, many people have heard of that, especially this year, it's the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. Even in the worst part of the Armenian Genocide, Armenians were largely safe at Smyrna. So it was a very special city, and it had a lot of symbolic value in it. And the destruction of Smyrna, especially in the way that it was destroyed and the slaughter that occurred, makes this especially a poignant story.
You mentioned the Armenian genocide. That's what it's called. But you say that that's actually a misleading term.
That's right. You know, the Armenian genocide definitely occurred. There's no question about that. You know, 1.5 million Armenians were killed in 1915 and 1916 by the Ottoman government. Terrible, terrible situation, and the Armenians are marking that centenary this year. But what most people don't realize is that it occurred inside a much broader religious cleansing, a mass slaughter, really, of all Christians inside the Ottoman Empire, especially what we call Anatolia, the core of the empire, the Turkish peninsula, Asia Minor. Began at about 1912. Greeks were killed and expelled from the coastal regions of western Turkey. And then it spread through the rest of the empire, and it intensified during World War I, the 1915-1916 period being the Armenian genocide. But it included Greeks, Armenians, and Assyrians. These were all ancient Christian peoples who were inside. They were subjects of the Ottoman Empire. You know, they were second-class subjects. They didn't enjoy full rights and so forth, but they were subjects of the Ottoman Empire. The killing continued through World War I. It stopped briefly after the war. The British occupied Constantinople and enforced some provisions of the peace, and it even prosecuted some Ottoman officials who had participated in all of this slaughter. But very quickly, the British lost control of the situation inside Turkey, even though it was a defeated nation in World War I, allied with Germany. And the killing began again under the banner of the nationalist Turkish forces and government. And it continued right up until 1922. And in fact, Smyrna represents the final big violent episode of that 10-year genocide that killed about 3 million people.
That's horrendous. Now, you mentioned the nationalists. There was Mustafa Kemal, who became known as Ataturk. Tell us about the nationalists and Mustafa Kemal.
Sure. Well, the nationalist movement was formed. It was a patriotic nationalist Turkish movement formed in opposition to the terms of the defeat that Turkey had suffered in World War I. Like with Germany, the Allies were going to impose a peace, a treaty, on Turkey. And, you know, it can be argued that it was punishing, maybe yes, maybe no. But in any event, it sparked outrage inside Turkey in the way that it did actually in Germany. But in Germany, the Allies, you know, literally occupied sections of Germany and enforced that treaty. But the treaty provisions started this nationalist movement, and it was a movement to reject the terms of the treaty of World War I, and also to push the Western powers, Britain and France in particular, out of Turkey. Both of those nations had designs on Turkey, taking pieces of it as mandated areas where they would have access to oil and so forth. So it was a sort of a patriotic movement under the leadership of a very unusual person, really one of the most interesting leaders of the 20th century, I think it's fair to say, Mustafa Kemal. He had a vision for a different kind of Turkey. He was a ruthless individual, but he was brilliant, single-minded, charismatic. And he was an extraordinary military leader as well. He had made his reputation at Gallipoli, where he had defeated the British and became a Turkish hero. And that heroism kind of carried him through into the nationalist movement, where he formed an army, literally from nothing. And it became a very formidable force. And it was the Turkish nationalist army that came to control Turkey, and it was the Turkish Nationalist Army that entered Smyrna in September of 1922, and then went out of control and began this slaughter of the Christian residents and eventually set the city on fire.
So one thing I don't understand is he was secular.
That's right.
So why was there this religious persecution?
Well, it's a really interesting story. Kamal was an exceptional individual. He was irreligious. You know, he had no interest in Islam or any religion for that matter. He manipulated the symbols of Islam in order to form an army and a government, but he himself, you know, was not at all religious. And he was exceptional in that regard. The people around him were Muslims, many of them quite devout. His army was an Islamic army, and it was a devout army. And it's extraordinary. By virtue of his charisma, his powerful personality, his ruthlessness, his single-mindedness, and so forth, he was regarded as more than a hero, in a way, by the Turkish people, because he had pinned the ears of the British back, so to speak, and demonstrated that he could be successful against the Western powers. And so that reputation and that high regard, they called him Ghazi, which has actually religious Islamic overtones, and it's a term that we associate with the Crusades, you know, being able to overcome Christian forces. He was able to implement his vision, and he did it without regard to life. I mean, he could be quite brutal. But interestingly, and here's the conundrum, the strange thing when we consider Mustafa Kemal, he did all of this, but he was trying to do such things as bring rights to women. You know, he got rid of the veil. He was trying to remove the symbols of Islam from the public square, to take it out of public life and so forth. So in some ways, he was a very reform-minded, had a Western point of view, but he was implementing these things without, you know, there were no referendums or elections and so forth. He was implementing it as a dictator, more or less. Interestingly, you know, he's the father of modern Turkey and the Turkey that we know today. Interestingly, that Kemalism, that secularism that we have associated for decades with Turkey, we're now seeing some of this rolled back. You know, there is the movement under Erdogan, the current prime minister, to bring Islam back into public life. There's a kind of nostalgia for the old Ottoman period and so forth. So we can see that Kemalism was a kind of veneer over Turkish Islamic life, and now that veneer is beginning to crack. But back in the 20s, he was the ruler, and he was the successful general, and he put his ideas in place and in practice.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Lou Jurenik about his book, The Great Fire, One American's Mission to Rescue Victims of the 20th Century's First Genocide. This is a book about a phenomenal rescue of really spearheaded by two Americans, but not with the support of the American establishment. So tell us, why was the U.S. there to begin with? What were our interests in the story?
Well, Smyrna had been a missionary station going back to the 1820s. It was actually the place where the American missionaries to Asia Minor, you know, trying to turn the Jews, the Orthodox Christians, and the Muslims into New England Protestants. that didn't work out so well, but you know, that's where it all began, at Smyrna, back in the 1820s. Over time, the missionary movement developed into kind of a social gospel movement, and there were a lot of clinics and schools and orphanages and so forth that were built by the missionaries. But Smyrna was a very important missionary station going back 100 years. In addition, America had a lot of big business interests there. The American cigarette industry would not have been possible without the kind of tobacco that passed through Smyrna. Turkish tobacco made American tobacco, Virginia Burley, palatable to American smokers. So we had all of the big tobacco companies were there at Smyrna. There was a cartel at Smyrna that really controlled about 95% of the Oriental carpet trade, again, creating these big fortunes, dried fruit, any number of other things. And the Americans were involved in all of this. We sold a lot of Singer sewing machines, Standard Oil sold a lot of kerosene. So we had a strong business interest in Smyrna, as well as a missionary station there.
So now these are twin stories coming together. One was, on the one hand, the U.S. presence and the presence of the West in Smyrna. On the other hand, some pretty big changes happening, a war that began out in the hinterland that featured a very crucial battle between Mustafa Kemal and the Greeks.
Right. You know, complicating this complicated story even further is this. The Allies, of course, won World War I. Britain, France as allies, and America as an associated power defeated Germany and Austria-Hungary and Bulgaria. The Ottoman Empire, Turkey, was an ally of Germany. It was a defeated nation. The Allies met in Paris after the war, famously at Versailles, to settle all of the various issues of the war. And the one area that proved really troublesome was deciding what to do with the Ottoman Empire. And there were contending forces among the Allies. They all had different ideas about what should be done and so forth. And there were also ideas generally about how the war should be settled. Very shortly into the talks, just a couple of months into the talks at Paris, the Italians walked out. They walked out because Woodrow Wilson, the United States president, refused to give them the city of Fiume as a war spoils. Fiume is on the Adriatic. It's a Slavic city. Wilson said, look, it's not Italian. You can't have it just because you were, you know, a victor in the war. Well, the Italians were very angry about this, and they decided not just to walk out, but they sent their navy and they sent troops to Turkey. And instead of getting Fiume, they were going to just seize Turkey as a war spoils, and especially Smyrna. That was what they were interested in getting. Well, Wilson and Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of Britain, two of the big three at the Paris peace talks, were furious about this. You know, they just couldn't believe that this was going to happen. But they weren't so furious that they were willing to send American or British troops to stop the Italians. What they did instead is they sent the Greeks. The Greeks were part of the Allies in World War I. They sent the Greeks to hold Smyrna against the Italians. And the idea was the Greeks also were making a claim to Western Turkey after the war. They had been promised this as a reward for getting into the war. There were also a lot of Greeks in some areas. They were the majority of the population, and they were being persecuted and so forth. So the Greeks had an argument for being there, but it was just an argument. But Wilson and Lloyd George sent the Greeks to Smyrna, the nation of Greece, its army and navy, to hold Smyrna against the Italians. Well, when that happened, this further inflamed the Turkish nationalist movement, which had already gotten underway because it wasn't happy with the terms of the peace treaty. So it helped Mustafa Kemal build his army, and soon there was a war between the nation of Greece in Asia Minor and Mustafa Kemal's army. And it was a brutal war. It lasted for, 3 years. And the Greeks were defeated. Slowly, the Allies abandoned Greece for a variety of reasons. It was not a pretty picture. The Greeks were terribly exposed in Asia Minor. It was a small, poor nation then, just as it is now. And Mustafa Kemal had the aid of Lenin, the new leader of Bolshevik Russia, and as it turned out, the Italians and the French were secretly aiding him against the British. So it was a real tangled mess. In any event, the Turkish nationalists overcame the Greeks, drove them out of Asia Minor, and it was that offensive that had them enter the city of Smyrna in September of 1922, setting the scene for the slaughter that occurred there, and then eventually the fire and the rescue.
Tell us about that fire. You have the most vivid descriptions of this terrible event. I mean, this was not an ordinary fire.
No, it surely wasn't. Well, the Turkish army entered the city on September 9, and very rapidly, within hours, the army was out of control, and it went to the Armenian quarter. The city was divided into districts, and began a slaughter. It was pulling people from their homes, raping the women, killing the families, looting the businesses, and so forth. It was just a horrible scene. Making matters worse was the fact that many hundreds of thousands of peasants, farmers mostly, from the interior of Turkey had fled ahead of the Turkish army as it was moving westward towards Smyrna, and had sought refuge. These peasants had sought refuge at Smyrna. They were sleeping in railroad stations, churchyards, cemeteries, the streets, wherever they could put down a blanket. 300,000 refugees in the city, in addition to the half a million people who already were there. living there. So September 9, the army is out of control, and it begins slaughtering Armenians in particular. And then in a matter of days, the massacre is sort of widespread through the city. There was no safe place for a Christian to be at Smyrna at that point. And then even more horribly, on Wednesday, September 13, the Turkish army set a series of fires around the Armenian neighborhood. There were four fires, and there's speculation about why the fires were set. Some people say it was to clean out all of the bodies that were piled up in the streets. Horrible, horrible thought. And there are other theories. We don't know why the fire was set, but we do know that the Turkish army set it because we have so many American witnesses to the fact, including some missionary teachers who were there in the Armenian quarter. The fire got out of hand, and it spread over the entire city. Big city, very densely packed city. And by midnight, the fire was 2 miles long and a mile deep. It was a huge fire. And it drove all of the people, you know, these refugees who were there with their little bit of food and their children and their animals and so forth, as well as the inhabitants of the city, the Christian inhabitants of the city, to the waterfront. Now, the way Smyrna is constructed, it's a harbor, it's a port city, and there is a kind of promenade that traces the edge of the harbor. It's about 2 miles long, and it's called the Quay. And in better times, it was the place where people would get dressed up, and women would have their parasols, and people would promenade, you know, past the beautiful hotels and mansions and so forth. But on that night of the fire, it was a cruel, cruel scene. Hundreds of thousands of people were packed into this very narrow quay trying to escape the fire. The fire was so hot that the ships in the harbor had to bring up their anchors and drop further out to sea because their canvas tarpaulins, their hemp lines, and so forth were igniting. So you can just imagine how hot it was for the people who were right there on the edge of the city. They were jumping into the water, drowning. Many were attempting to swim out to the ships unsuccessfully. They were getting chewed up in the ship's propellers. It was just a horrible scene. The fire burned for 3.5 days, and you know, we don't know how many people died. You know, nobody was counting bodies, but it was a terrible scene. Many people died, both from the fire and from drowning, and of course the harassment of by the Turkish army. Now, one of the sad elements of even sadder, I mean, all of this is pretty bad, but the world was focused on what was happening at Smyrna. It was the lead story in the New York Times for 2 weeks. I mean, everybody knew what was happening. It was the big story in every newspaper in America. People were really concerned about the Christians in Asia Minor. They had, you know, it had been a lot of help given to them over the previous decade by America. So Americans were very familiar with the event and the issue, but the government was doing nothing.
Why was that?
Basically, it came down to self-interest in the case of each country. In the case of the United States, two things were at work. There was a core group at the State Department who were trying to figure out how does the United States maintain access to Near East oil. We were already having our first oil crisis in 1922, believe it or not, and there was a lot of concern about getting oil out of the Near East, as it was called in those years. And so there was a sense that the Turkish nationalist government would prevail, and we wanted to be on the right side, on the winning team, so to speak, so that we could have access to that oil. So that was one reason the United States didn't act. Also, Warren Harding had been elected as a president who was not going to get involved in foreign wars and foreign activities and entanglements and so forth, so he was disinclined to get involved. And then, you know, making matters worse, it wasn't the most crucial factor, but it certainly added to the pain and suffering. We had at Constantinople an ambassador, so-called high commissioner, who was a despicable figure, I have to say. His name was Mark Bristol. He was an admiral. He was both a Navy officer and a State Department official. And he made no bones over the fact that he didn't like Greeks, Armenians, and Jews. He came right out and said it. And he did not want to participate in a rescue. He gave his commanders, he had a detachment of destroyers in the Black Sea and in the Mediterranean. He said, you know, don't get involved. We're going to protect American property. You know, he was willing to put guards around the tobacco warehouses and so forth, but he was not willing to assist in the rescue of any of the refugees. So the great powers were paralyzed out of self-interest in a way. And fortunately, there was a small American community associated with the missionaries and the businesses and so forth, about 150 people. And the leaders of those various groups, they formed an American Relief Committee, and they began to do good work. Shelter, food, medicine, and so forth. They raised money. They donated their own private funds and so forth. One of the members of the relief committee was a YMCA employee, the least likely hero you could possibly imagine. His name was Asa Jennings, and he becomes very important to the story. First thing he did was occupy a series of these grand mansions that had been vacated by their owners ahead of the Turkish army, and he turned them into safe houses for women who had been raped, and there were a lot of them in Smyrna, a place for them to get some medical care and protection. He stayed in the city even as the fire burned, on that terrible first night. So he took that first step, and then he took an important second step. It soon became clear that nobody was going to do anything. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were likely to die at Smyrna. The only answer was evacuation, and that seemed an impossibility. So many people. Well, Jennings took first one step, and then a second step, and a third step, and quite improbably, I mean, this is really the sort of the nub of the book, and I won't give it all away, but I'll just say that faced with this terrible potential loss of life, he told a few lies, he paid some bribes, he overstated his portfolio, he misrepresented what the U.S. Navy was willing to do, and he basically extorted a foreign government. And in a matter of days, he had taken command of a flotilla, nearly 50 ships. And working with a U.S. Navy commander who was essentially disobeying his orders, his name was Halsey Powell, and at this point, in late September, he was the American senior naval officer at Smyrna. Halsey Powell conspired with Asa Jennings to put together a rescue. And quite improbably, they were able to bring unflagged merchant ships escorted by U.S. destroyers into Smyrna Harbor when all hope was lost. For an evacuation, the Turkish military gave them a deadline, 7 days to remove all of these people, which, of course, was an impossibility. I mean, the logistics weren't there, and there were just too many people. But they did it. Somehow they got 250,000 people out of that city in 7 days. They brought them to the island of Lesbos, nearby, a Greek island, which was overwhelmed itself. There was hunger and disease there, but at least they weren't being killed and raped. They went on to actually rescue people from other parts of Turkey later in 1922 and in early 1923. But the really crucial and miraculous, I have to say, rescue was the way that they removed, and it was almost all women and children because the men were not allowed to leave. The men were marched into the interior by the Turkish army, which essentially was a death sentence. They removed 250,000 women and children and some old men from Smyrna to Lesbos in the course of 7 days. Just amazing.
What happened to those people?
Well, they were eventually resettled in Greece. And following all of these calamitous and catastrophic events, there was a peace treaty signed between Greece and Turkey, and there was a population exchange. And by the time the whole thing was over, the population of Greece had swelled by 25%, all of whom were refugees. So they were resettled mostly in Athens and Thessaloniki initially, and then later the League of Nations got involved and resettled many of these people in northern Greece, Macedonia, Thrace, Thraki as the Greeks call it. Today there are millions of people alive. You know, we're 2-3 generations now removed from the fire at Smyrna. There are millions of people alive today in Greece and in the rest of the world, here in the United States, as a consequence of this heroic rescue by Asa Jennings and Captain Powell.
It's a phenomenal story, and the story is told by my guest, Lou Jurenek. It's called The Great Fire, One American's Mission to Rescue Victims of the 20th Century's First Genocide. This story has been largely forgotten until now, until your book. Why?
Well, it's a great question. I wondered the same thing when I began. You know, I think of it as one of the great stories of an American hero that nobody knows about. So why is that? Well, it turns out that there is an explanation. After the events were over, let's say the middle of the end of 1923, there was a big debate inside the United States about whether this country should have a diplomatic and commercial relationship with Turkey. A big part of the population and nearly all of the religious leaders of the country said no. Turkey has too much blood on its hands. We can't simply overlook this religious cleansing, this genocide that just occurred, as well as what happened at Smyrna, you know, part of that. We can't overlook that. Either time has to pass, there has to be some reckoning, but there's no justice in immediately establishing diplomatic ties. Well, the other point of view was articulated by a group of professionals inside the State Department, led in particular by a person who becomes prominent later in the century, Alan Dulles. He was the chief of the Near East desk at the State Department in those years. You know, he later became head of the CIA and famous for toppling governments, including governments in the Near East. His point of view was that it's in the U.S. interest to have a commercial relationship with Turkey. So there was a kind of propaganda, misinformation, disinformation campaign started by the State Department to diminish the suffering that had occurred in Turkey, to sort of erase the story of the genocide and the religious cleansing from the American mind, so that the American public would be willing to go forward with a Turkish relationship. So, you know, they introduced concepts, you know, such as, well, this was an internal affair, you know, both sides were horrible to each other, it was sort of tit for tat, all of which was not correct. It's a distortion of history. But that was the argument put forward by the State Department, and ultimately it prevailed. And I mean, even to this day, it's one of the reasons, I think, why the Armenian Genocide is not fully understood and appreciated and acknowledged, is that way back, the State Department sought to diminish what had happened in order to build a new relationship with a new Turkey. And the Asa Jennings story and really all of what had happened was lost in the process.
So what are the lessons of this story? I mean, maybe you could elaborate on that. What are the lessons of the Smyrna story?
Well, the United States, Britain, and France won the war, you know, against Germany and its allies. But it lost the peace in the sense that the United States lost interest in international affairs, believe it or not. I mean, there was a very strong movement to just withdraw from the world, and the Americans did that. So it sort of lost interest in enforcing a just peace after the war. Britain also shirked its responsibilities in terms of being a war victor. So the lesson that I derive is that when wars are fought or when there are big conflicts in the world, national governments, they need to adopt smart and consistent policies. When you're a world power, there are certain responsibilities that come with that. And, you know, they can be expensive, they can be unpleasant, but they need to be shouldered to avoid future conflicts. And I think that that basically is the lesson. The West sort of made a mess of the peace process after World War I, and the consequence was a lot of death in Asia Minor.
Lou Jurenik also says that interest in protecting access to oil has been an important factor in distorting the policy of the big powers toward the Middle East.
Thirst for oil, our, you know, determination to protect those oil supplies, we have made deals with the devil, and it has created an enormous number of problems for us. It goes all the way back to this period. We see oil emerging as a shaper of U.S. foreign policy during this Smyrna episode, and of course it continues, you know, right up into the present. Our thirst for oil has distorted our foreign policy. There's no question about it. It's created a lot of damage and a lot of death.
Right, right, exactly. Well, this is a fascinating book, The Great Fire, by my guest, Lou Jurenik. This is just a terrific read, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Journalist Lou Jurenik. To learn more and see pictures of the Great Fire of Smyrna, go to writersvoice.net. We link to Jurenik's website about the fire there. Next up, a tale about an orphan and a con artist in wartime England. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. British novelist Lissa Evans is perhaps best known on this side of the pond for her children's books, Horton's Miraculous Mechanisms and Horton's Incredible Illusions. But her latest novel is a treat for grown-ups. A kind of black comedy set in World War II England, it tells the story of a precocious 10-year-old orphan, Noel, who's taken in by a small-time con artist named Vera when he's evacuated from the London Blitz. Vera thinks taking Noel in will bring her some much-needed extra income from the government. But Noel soon becomes the mastermind of their petty cons, and in so doing, they end up helping the helpless and seeing that the real criminals come to justice. It's a delightful story that has garnered praise from the critics, and a sequel is, of course, in the works. I spoke to Lissa Evans via Skype in July. So, Lissa Evans, this book, Crooked Heart, takes place during the London Blitz. I wonder if you could read a short excerpt from this book and set us up. Tell us what's going on here and then read the excerpt.
Right. What's going on in this scene is that Noel, who is 10, who has been brought up by his godmother, an ex-suffragette and very eccentric, clever woman, has, when she no longer look after him, has been evacuated from London at the start of the Blitz. And he's very unhappy, and he's in a railway carriage leaving London with some other children from his school. Hitler was thumbing his nose from just across the channel, and London had decided to move the children out again, all the ones that had come back and all the ones who had never gone. This time Noel was going with them. Once again, he hadn't been consulted. When the whistle blew at St. Pancras, he watched the guards slide backwards. The train moved from under the blacked-out roof and sunshine slapped him in the face. He wrote, "I am sitting next to Harvey Madeley. His backside is so enormous that he is wearing his father's trousers cut down into shorts." "Here we all are," said Mr. Waring, entering the compartment. "The real street school fifth column, and young Noel with his pencil and paper, a child among you, taking notes." "Where are we going, sir?" asked someone. "All very hush-hush," said Mr. Waring. "I have not been party to the plans." "Is it Wales?" "Let us hope not." "They don't speak English in Wales," said one of the Ferris twins. "The only discernible difference," wrote Noel, "between the Ferris twins is that one of them is even more cretinous than the other." "They eat squirrels in Wales," said the other Ferris twin. "I were going with cows again," said Alice Beddoes. "In Dorset I could see a cow out of every window, and I could smell a cow out of every window." "Corn beef!" said Roy Percy, peering into the brown paper bag that the volunteer had given him. "Don't open the bags yet," ordered Mr. Waring. Everybody but Noel immediately opened their bags. "The items these contain are for your foster mothers, not for consuming on the journey," said Mr. Waring. But Roy Percy had already started to turn the key on the tin of corned beef. Noel watched as a thin pink wound began to gape around the top of the tin. "Biscuits!" shouted Harvey Madeley. "When we find ourselves at midnight, progressing at a walking pace up the northwest coast of Scotland," said Mr. Waring, "you may come to regret your current greed." He leaned back in his seat and opened a book. I think to set that up as well a little more, the children of London were evacuated, voluntarily, but most of them went, on the first day of the Second World War. But because the first year was referred to as the phony war, there was no bombing, there was nothing apparently going on. Loads of children drifted back to London during that year, and then they were all evacuated again when the Blitz actually started.
Well, that is just a terrific excerpt there, and really gives us a flavor of one of your two main characters, and that is 10-year-old Noel. He is just an absolutely marvelously drawn kid. Tell us a little bit more about him. Where did he come from? And this unique voice that he has.
Noel, we don't find out very much about his background in this. Noel has been, since the age of four, living with Matty, who's an ex-suffragette of independent means, in a house on Hampstead Heath, which is a huge area of wild parkland just north of the centre of London. And they've lived there in happy independence. He's a very bright boy. She has nurtured that brightness. And he doesn't fit in with other children of his own age, but he adores Matty and she adores him. And at the beginning of the war, she begins to succumb to dementia. She's always been determined there isn't going to be a war, and the onset of the war pushes her over the edge. And she loses the ability to look after him, so that when he is eventually evacuated, he's almost mute with grief. And he's mistaken for what she unkindly thinks of as a simpleton by a woman called Vera Sedge, who is in a small country city to which she's evacuated. And Vera Sedge lives in scrabbling poverty with her leech-like mother and teenage son who has failed the army medical. And she is constantly looking around for ways to earn money, usually illegally, but also ineptly. She's just too desperate, she's too impulsive to carry her plans through. And she's currently trying to raise money through rattling a collection box for a fake charity from door to door, because there are a lot of wartime charities. But she's not very good at it. But in Noel, she finds the cool, clever planning head that she needs to actually run a good scam, and together they become a scamming team going through the bond suburbs of North London collecting money for fake charities as a widow and her son.
So one might think that, well, this makes them not a very sympathetic pair, but they are, and these are two characters that you really draw in great detail. I think when we first meet Vera, I had to say I was a little put off by her, but as time goes on, you realize that she's a woman who is trying to respond creatively to survive to the difficult of context in which she finds herself. I mean, after all, it's not just the war. It's also an issue of her class, the fact that she's poor.
Yes, her morality is thinly spread, shall we say. She's actually quite religious. She's been brought up Methodist and she thinks quite a lot in biblical verse. But life has been one disaster after another. She got pregnant when she was not married. She ended up marrying a man who was battered both physically and mentally by the First World War, and who subsequently died. She has a son with a heart complaint. Her mother is almost mute. And she is basically surrounded by dependents who think nothing of her. And she scrabbles to get by, and it's not until she finds somebody who can appreciate her that she starts blossoming. And that person is, in the end, Noel.
Yes, and their relationship unfolds in a delicious manner. I talk a little bit more also, though, about the general, shall we say, erosion of a conventional morality during the London Blitz, during this time. And this is not the first book that you've written about this time, the home, about, I guess, what the British call the home front during World War II. So talk about what happens to, you know, moral values, moral precepts during a time like this.
Well, that's a really interesting question, because what I really found out when I was researching the Blitz, and I started my research years ago when I was writing the book before this one, as you say, it was also set during the Second World War, but it was about the making of a feature film. And there was lots and lots of research I could do. There were people I could talk to. There were endless films to watch. But I became absolutely fascinated by the Blitz, because it was an extraordinary time, but it was full of ordinary people trying to do ordinary things. Because even when bombs are falling all around, it's still a big issue if you break the heel of your shoe, or you drop the only egg that is in your egg ration that week, or your best coat gets ruined because you get caught in a bomb blast. These things continue to be important. And what really struck me about the Blitz was not that there was any kind of breakdown in morality, but that ordinary life went on in all its forms. So during the Blitz, you can find heroism, you can find cowardice, you can find extraordinary actions, and you can find petty, mean actions as well. And for the first book, as I say, there were so many sources of research. But for the second book, I was writing about petty criminals, I was writing about people living on the edge, I was writing about marginalised people and debtors. And they're not the kind of people who write memoirs, who are interviewed for television programmes, who keep diaries. And the way I found my way into their world was by reading the local newspaper for St Albans, which is the town that that Vera in this lives in, a small... It's actually a city because it's got a cathedral, but it's a small country town. And reading that, it was extraordinary because it had lots of aspects of the war in it. There was stuff about rationing, there was stuff about evacuees. It wasn't bombed, but there was lots going on about the war. But there was also crime going on throughout the war, petty crime, quite serious crime in some ways. There were smash and grab raids in small shops, and there was theft as well. But there was also, going further afield in the more bombed areas, there was looting, which is going in stealing stuff from bombed places. And that was very, very heavily punished. There were very few cases actually came as far as court because most people avoided it. But the people who could loot almost with impunity were the people in uniform. If you're a policeman, if you're a warden, if you're a fireman, you had open access to bombed areas. And of course there were tremendously honest ones, they were brave ones, but there were also cheats and crooks. They were all there. Everyone was there.
Well, of course, war provides a fertile ground for crimes of opportunity. You know, I think of the TV series Foyle's War that often featured this kind of petty corruption.
Absolutely. And also, it's a time when if you want to disappear, if you want to change who you are, it's a time when you can easily do that. It was a time when people could literally disappear in a bombing, either by death or by deciding to start again somewhere.
Right. So now the plot, you know, brings in a number of the lesser characters. I don't want to give too much away, but perhaps you could talk a little bit about Vera's son and his relationship to the story.
Yes, I can. And I will say what his particular scam is, because it comes in fairly early in the book. Donald is 19 and he's been called up and he went along to his medical. And at his medical, it was discovered that he had a heart murmur. A heart murmur that wasn't symptomatic, but that in future might cause him problems, but probably not for many years. Now, for some people, that might be considered a major tragedy. For Donald, it was fantastic. He was being told that he didn't have to go to war. He had an excuse for pretending that he was tired all the time to make his mum do even more work. But what happened was the next day he was contacted by a friend who said, you know what, you can make a bit of money from that. And this was based on real cases that I found where people with heart murmurs could turn up at army medicals impersonating other people who didn't want to be called up. So say you didn't want to be called up, say you had a business going on or you were scared or you just didn't want to go, you could pay somebody really quite a lot of money, between £80 and £150. They would pretend to be you, wave their papers, get the medical, find out they had a heart murmur and be declared unfit for service. And Donald is raking it in doing this. And he's not a nice character, but something happens to him during the book which changes his character. I don't want to give that away too much.
Right, right. Because after all, this is a kind of a mystery story, although it's not a murder mystery. Now, the scams and schemes of the main characters do cause them to run a risk. And there's a delicate balance here in this book, Crooked Heart, in your novel, Lissa Evans, a delicate balance between scamming and rectitude, especially with the character of Noel. I mean, he's really a good lad, even though he's involved in a scam. And in fact, in some ways, is his mastermind. But it's all something he takes on an altruistic project that becomes very important to him. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, he does, because Noel doesn't really consider what he's doing to be wrong. And that this is thrown into relief when they stumble across a real crime, somebody being really hurt by a rather cruel theft by someone else. And Noel ends up having a conversation with his teacher, Mr. Waring, who is a Catholic, and they talk about morality and about venial sins and about mortal sins. And Noel decides that the sin that Noel declares himself to be an atheist very, very early on in the book, because that's the way Matthew brought him up. But he decides that what he's doing is a venial sin because it doesn't hurt anyone. In the end, people have given him sixpence or a shilling. It's cost them only that. And it's given Noel and Vee a lot of pleasure and some money along the way. But a real sin, he decides, is one in which someone is hurt, someone innocent is hurt. And it's all about right and wrong, but more at the end he distinguishes it between morally right and legally right. It's all right if something's legally wrong if it's morally right. Noel is very precise about these things. Vee just goes with the flow.
Mm-hmm. And tell us how you got inside the mind of a 10-year-old with such deliciousness, shall we say.
I write about 10-year-olds a lot. I write children's books as well as adult books for adults. And my protagonist in the children's books is also 10. And I think this is because I moved house when I was 10. And I have a very, very clear snapshot of my mind at that age. It's very easy, it's very difficult to pinpoint different ages when you look back at yourself. I can't really remember what I was like at 14 or 7, but 10, I can remember that exactly. And therefore, I tend to make my children that age in books because I can live inside their heads. And like Noel, I wasn't as clever as Noel, but like Noel, I had unwieldy vocabulary. I was out of step with other children, which was particularly thrown into relief when I moved from near London to the Midlands, where everything was different, including the accent. And I remember what it was like to sit in judgment on other children while being intensely unhappy myself. So I used those. But I also fell in love with Nola as a character, and I fell in love with Matty as well, who is this suffragette who brings him up. To the extent that I'm actually now writing a book about Matty.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Matty's pretty cool.
Oh, that's great. And she's the woman of independent means who was a suffragette. Oh, I so look forward to seeing that.
Oh, thank you. A born contrarian, as somebody called her, which I think is a wonderful phrase. And it's tempting as a title. I don't know whether I would use it. So I'm heavily into researching suffragettes at the moment.
That's terrific. And when did women get the vote in Britain?
They got the vote for over 30 in 1918, but they didn't get the vote for all women over 21 until 1928. Long time, isn't it? You got there before us.
Really? Did we?
Yes, you didn't need to, the US didn't need to move towards the militant way of protesting, because you managed to get the vote rather ahead of us.
Huh, and yes, and so these women were actually jailed in England.
Oh my goodness, I am enjoying the research so much. I did know something about it. You grow up knowing a bit about it. But the sort of explosion of energy and the militancy consisted of doing immensely brave things, but also silly and fun things. These were women who would have been expected not very long before that to sit and sew and wait for marriage. And suddenly they at one end of the scale, they were committing arson and setting fire to letterboxes, but the others, they were going into meetings with cabinet ministers, public meetings, where they would simply stand on a chair and shout, "What are you going to do about votes for women?" over and over and over again. There was another woman who turned up at cabinet ministers' meetings and ring a bell really loudly so that he couldn't be heard. The energy, the organisation of it was just incredible. And I totally support the militants of it, because they were never going to get the vote by just asking parliamentary questions. The British government did everything they could to stop women from getting the vote.
Well,
you can hear our passions about it.
Oh, no, that's terrific. And is that the sequel to this book, basically a prequel that you're writing?
I'm going to write both. I'm writing a prequel first, and then I'm going to write a sequel set about 3 years after the end of this book.
Oh, really? So it would be still during the war, or would it be?
It would be about 1944. That's when the V-1 and V-2 rockets. So it was the second wave of the Blitz when Germany started sending unarmed rockets across. It was an extraordinary time. There were two sorts. There was one called Doodlebugs, which was a sort of unarmed plane where you'd hear an engine coming over, and when it stopped, you knew it would drop. So that was very frightening. And then there were V2s, which were simply rockets, like gigantic bullets sent from Germany, where you hear nothing apart from a colossal explosion and streets of houses destroyed. It was dramatic and horrible.
Wow. Now, I had a question. What was the... Oh, yes. So you have also written for television. You wrote comedies for TV and also for radio.
I produced. I produced and directed. I never wrote for TV and radio.
Oh, I see.
I script edited, produced and directed, yes. So it wasn't until I started writing my first novel that I really sat down and wrote something. That was in year 2000.
Oh, so were there ways in which your work for radio and television contributed to the way that you write?
Absolutely. Partly the skill of editing, which is so useful, endlessly useful. People write in different ways. People, you know, there are people who write 200,000 words and then edit it back. I edit fiercely as I go along, really quite stringently. I don't allow myself to stray from the path of the plot too much. And by the time I get to the end of the book, it doesn't normally need very much in the way of rewrites. So that shaped the way I write. But also, I work with some very, very good writers, and the skill of writing funny lines is something that I aspire to, and something that cannot be praised enough, in my opinion. It's far, far more difficult to write a funny line than it is to write a serious one. There's no doubt about it. Everything I am as a writer came from that path.
Well, I think it really does show in Crooked Heart, in your novel, Lissa Evans. You know, the writing is it's very efficient and very funny. I mean, I laughed out loud quite a few times. And it is a wonderful book. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. I look forward to talking with you about both sequels to this book.
Thank you so much, Francesca. Thank you.
Lissa Evans is the author of 9 books, including several for children. We hope to be speaking with her about her sequel or prequel to Crooked Heart. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.